disappear, to commit suicide, and to take with them as many others as they could. The Techno-Arcadians' strategy involved disguising their operations as the work of terrorists and madmen, seeding social chaos so the public would cry out for order. This would allow a steady ratcheting up of security measures and rights restrictions until such a day that even those who had not been adjusted with brain implants would celebrate the firm but enlightened rule of their betters. Construction fencing surrounded the school and its immediate grounds, but the fabric privacy panels attached to the chain link had in many places been slashed away by the curious. Signs that warned of toxic chemicals and of the unstable nature of the ruins had been defaced with obscene suggestions. The building should have been demolished, but although the ruins had been combed repeatedly for clues, the ongoing federal investigations required that the site be preserved to avoid the destruction of possible evidence. The school backed up to a football field, flanked by stadium seating beyond the view of the street. Gilberto drove the GL-550 across that weedy, untended expanse of ground, gaining speed until he rammed the gate in the fence, broke the cheap hinges, and slammed through the rickety barrier. With shattered headlights and a buckled hood, the Mercedes came to a stop on the former faculty parking lot, where the undulant blacktop had been deformed and imprinted with fern-like patterns by the heat pouring off the burning building. They were about half a mile from the residential street on which Gilberto had parked his Suburban earlier that morning.
"There's a shortcut," he said. "I won't be as much as 10 minutes, maybe a couple minutes less."
Together, he and Jane propped the damaged gate in place. It looked reasonably intact in the unlikely event someone chanced by. She returned to the Mercedes and opened the tailgate and took Hendrickson's pulse, which was steady, if somewhat slow. She lifted the red neckerchief and watched his eyes moving under their lids. He muttered wordlessly and yawned. She replaced the cloth and sprayed it lightly with chloroform. The sun was still 40 minutes below the summit of the sky, but the shadow cast by the school seemed longer than it should have been this close to noon. She heard traffic noise in the distance, but nothing nearby. No trilling bird, no settling noises in the ruins. Even the damaged Mercedes and its cooling engine failed to make a sound, as if 300 casualties in one blazing hour had left this area forever a dead zone. In Newport Coast, they would have found and freed Simon by now. They would know that 2 vehicles were missing from his collection. They would have determined that Jane Hawke and a male accomplice had departed the scene in Simon's Mercedes. Thereafter, it would take only a few minutes to get the registration number of the vehicle from the DMV and cross-check with the manufacturer's records to obtain the unique signal of the GPS. It was too much to hope that the minor damage caused by the impact with the gate in the construction fencing had disabled the GPS to the extent of silencing the transponder by which the Mercedes could be tracked. The wolves would soon be coming. 20. Tanuja Shukla woke, opened her eyes without lifting her head from the pillow, and saw it was 11:19 a.m. on Saturday. The clock must be wrong. She never slept so late. Besides, she remained tired to the bone, as though, after an exhausting day, she had been asleep only 2 or 3 hours. She was wearing her wristwatch. She never wore it to bed. But there it was, on her wrist. The watch and clock concurred. She threw back the covers and sat on the edge of the mattress. Her pajamas were damp with sweat and clung to her body. A soreness at one corner of her mouth. She put a hand to her lips. Dried blood crumbled against her fingertips. For a moment she was mystified. But then she remembered the fall. Last night, standing in the wet dark, soaked and chilled and lonely and wildly happy, cataloging the details of the foul weather as well as her physical and emotional responses to it,
the better to write about the journey of the lead character in her novelette. The storm spoke through the medium of the nearby ancient oak, each leaf a tongue empowered by raindrops, the tree telling the storm's story in a chorus of soft clicks and hisses. When she had returned to the house, she'd slipped on the rain-puddled, glossy paint of the back porch floor, slipped and fell face first into one of the rocking chairs, the arm of one of the chairs. Stupid of her. Clumsy. She would need to eat and drink with care for the next couple days. Now, as she got up from the bed, she felt sticky, dirty, and sore in places that the fall did not fully explain. An odor clung to her separate from the stale smell of her night sweat, a malodor that was familiar, disturbingly familiar, but her past experience of it. Where? When? Eluded her. As she went into her bathroom, step by step, the odor became a stink, became a stench, and incipient nausea slid around the walls of her stomach. She had felt dirty a moment earlier, but she felt filthy now. She was overcome by an urgent desire for a shower, an almost frantic need to be clean. The compulsion was peculiar. But it meant nothing. Nothing at all. Standing in a forceful spray of water as hot as she could tolerate, scrubbing herself with a soapy washcloth, she winced at the pain in her breasts and discovered that they were bruised. She must have fallen more fully into the chair than she remembered. When she felt clean at last, and the threat of nausea had passed, she continued to linger there, eyes closed, turning slowly, letting the hot shower melt some of the soreness out of her. The sound of the rushing water returned to her a memory of the previous evening's storm. The sky black, the rain like an inkfall where there was no light to color it, the old oak in elaborate black figuration against the deeper black of the night, and sudden movement that was also black on black. Three robed and hooded figures hurrying through the downpour, like a scene from some film concerning medieval monks engaged in an urgent mission during apocalyptic times. Tanuja's breath caught in her chest, and she opened her eyes, half expecting to see those monks gathered around the shower stall, three walls of which were glass. Of course, no hooded figures stood watching her. Such an odd moment. But it meant nothing. Nothing at all. After she'd blown dry her hair and dressed, she went in search of Sanjay. She found him in his study, where the door stood open to the hall. He sat at the computer, his back to her, hunched over the keyboard, typing faster than she had ever before seen him type, as though a scene from his current novel in progress flowed from him on a tide of inspiration. To write fiction well, long periods of intense concentration were nearly as important as talent. She and her brother so respected the creative process that neither would interrupt the other during working hours, except for matters significant and urgent. She went to the kitchen. As she fitted the paper filter in the coffee maker, she detected an astringent chemical odor, the source of which was not at once evident. By the time she put the coffee and a half teaspoon of cinnamon in the filter, the smell so bothered her that she prowled the room in search of its origin. The kitchen was sparkling. In fact, cleaner than she recalled leaving it the previous night. The offensive odor was not strong, but waned and waxed and waned again. Indeed, it wasn't entirely a bad smell. There was in general a lemony fragrance, like that of the antibacterial spray she used to wipe down the counters, but under it lingered a persistent acridness. She was drawn to the quartz-topped table, where red roses, the stems cut short in a low arrangement, filled a crystal bowl. Neither of the odors came from the flowers, and yet the blooms fascinated her. She stared at the coagulum of blood-red petals for a long moment. until her gaze was drawn to an unlikely object lying on the table beside the bowl. A hypodermic needle. The barrel of the syringe was filled with a cloudy amber fluid. It was an exotic item, but at the same time curiously familiar. A sense of déjà vu overcame her, and the feeling that some moment of a forgotten dream had here manifested in real life. When she reached for the syringe, it ceased to be there on the table, and her fingers closed only on each other. In that instant, she recognized the chemical odor as that of insecticide, specifically spectracide hornet spray. Mystery solved. Except that hornets were not in season. Well, yes, but she and Sanjay did sometimes use the spray for ants. As for the syringe, how strange. But it meant nothing. Nothing at all. Tanuja returned to the coffee maker. She filled the Pyrex pot with water to the 10-cup level, because when Sanjay smelled the coffee brewing, he would want some too. In a few minutes, the kitchen grew redolent of the fine Jamaica blend, and Tanuja breathed deeply of the wonderful aroma while she cracked eggs for an omelet. She wanted some potatoes as well, and bacon, and toast. She was ravenous. 21. At one time there had been security cameras, because in recent decades too many schools were not merely centers of education, but also dens of drug dealing and violence. In the aftermath of the fire, however, there were no cameras intact, and no electricity to power them. Nevertheless, Jane felt watched, and she studied one broken-out window after another, searching for a faint human form in the charry darkness beyond. Her intuition, which she trusted implicitly, told her that no one lurked in the building, but she scanned the windows anyway. Months of being on the run, with enemies who commanded a panoply of surveillance platforms ranging from simple traffic cams to satellites in orbit, had brought her to that point at which healthy stage one paranoia could metastasize into a cancerous stage four, which might paralyze her or lead her into fatal misjudgments. When Gilberto returned in 8 minutes, Jane dragged open the damaged gate in the construction fencing to admit him. He backed the Suburban up to the Mercedes GL550. Together, they moved Hendrickson from one vehicle to the other. She also transferred her tote, the attaché case packed with money, and the MedExpress carrier that she had for a while stowed in one of Simon Yegg's refrigerators. As Jane closed the tailgate, a sudden siren coiled through the morning, close and spiraling louder, surely within a block of the school. Much too close for them to escape without being seen. Once spotted, the Suburban would inevitably later be identified because it would be tracked from the school by Arcadian operatives able to review archived video from traffic cameras, its ultimate destination uncovered. When the vehicle was associated with Booth Hendrickson's abduction, with Jane, it would incriminate Gilberto and bring hellfire upon him and his entire family. Their eyes locked. And they froze in anticipation, as though they stood on a hangman's platform with rope around their necks, waiting for trapdoors to fall open beneath their feet. The siren Doppler shifted to lower frequencies as the cops or paramedics or whoever they were passed the school and raced away to whatever crime or car wreck they had been summoned. Gilberto drove, and Jane sat in the back seat, the better to monitor the unconscious captive lying in the cargo area.
"I called Carmela," Gilberto said. "She's taken the kids to visit her sister in Dana Point. They'll stay the weekend."
"I'm so sorry. This is exactly what I didn't want, bringing all this right into your home."
"Not your fault. What happened, happened. There's no other option that makes sense."
"I'm still trying to think of one." They crossed the rutted and weedy football field, circled the farther stack of bleachers, turned left into an alley, and slipped away into the Suburban sprawl.
For the moment, they had eluded the agents of Utopia who would, without hesitation or remorse, kill them in the name of social progress. She could think of no viable option other than the one Gilberto offered her. How strangely apt it was to find herself harried to a mortuary to seek refuge with the dead, while in her hands she held the life of this man Hendrickson, who had ordered and or assisted in uncounted murders. 22. Sanjay Shukla sat at his computer in a condition he'd never known before. Not merely inspired to write, but impelled to write, as though he'd been bitten by some exotic mosquito that carried not any wasting disease, but instead a communicable need to create. No, not just a need. The word need implied a lack of something, a deficiency that he might or might not fill. The extreme urgency with which he was motivated to string together words into sentences allowed no choice between might or might not, but incited him to write as if his very existence depended on the quality of what he created. He was gripped not by the need to write, but by the necessity, for there was no alternative to writing. He pounded the keyboard as if fever-driven, raining a tropical storm of words onto the screen, with none of his usual careful crafting. He had awakened from a half-remembered dream seething with kaleidoscopic images of menace and horror. He had at once been obsessed with writing a story about a man who'd been obliged to protect an innocent child and failed to do so, by his failure allowing the child to perish. He had no complete story in mind. He knew only that when the child perished, so did all innocence in the world, whereupon civilization fell into a darkness that would never know a dawn. The narrative flowed from him without a conventional structure, a stream of consciousness rant in the voice of the father who had failed the child. Although Sanjay strove to bring coherence to the story, the English language became a wallow of vexatious snakes that he could not wrangle into a satisfying story. Nevertheless, he wrote at a blistering pace for an hour, 2 hours, three, until the tips of his fingers were tender from the force with which he'd struck the keys. His neck ached, and a heaviness gathered in his chest as if his heart had swollen with retained blood. He stopped typing and sat in bewilderment. For how long, he did not know, until he smelled coffee brewing, bacon frying. The aromas stirred him as if from a dream, as if he had never fully awakened when he had gone from his bed to his office chair. He saved what he had written and got up and went into the kitchen. At the cooktop, using tongs, Tanuja turned bacon in a frying pan. She looked at him and smiled. "Omelette, in the warming drawer. I've made enough for two. The toast is about to pop up. Butter it, will you? Plenty of butter on mine." Sanjay meant to say that he was starving, but instead he said, "I'm so empty." If she thought his statement strange, she didn't remark on it, but said, "We need to eat, that's all. Just eat and get on with it." Which seemed to him nearly as peculiar as the words that he had spoken. The toast popped up. He buttered it. 23. The mortuary cosmetician was at work in the basement. The assistant mortician and his intern had driven the decedent from the previous night's viewing to the cemetery, where a graveside service would soon be underway. No other viewing had been scheduled until 6 o'clock this evening. The place was as quiet as a funeral home. After stripping off Hendrickson's suit coat and shoulder rig, they strapped him to a gurney on which cadavers were transported, and they wheeled him through the back entrance into the vestibule. With Gilberto at the head of the gurney and Jane at the foot, they bumped it up the stairs to the family apartment on the top floor.
The sleek and airy modern decor was in stark contrast to the ornate moldings, heavy velvet draperies, and neo-Gothic furniture on the ground floor. As they wheeled Hendrickson through the living room and along a hallway, Jane said, "What's it like to live with the dead?"
"Same as it is for everyone else," Gilberto replied, "except we realize we live with them. All of us are the dead in waiting, but most people put it out of their mind."
"The kids ever have nightmares?"
"Yeah, but not about the dead."
She left him in the kitchen with Hendrickson and returned to the Suburban to get her tote, the attaché case, and the MedExpress carrier. When she returned to the kitchen, Gilberto had adjusted the gurney, jacking up the back end, so Hendrickson remained strapped across his arms and legs, but reclining at a 45-degree angle rather than lying flat.
"A mortician doesn't need this feature," Gilberto said, "but they make gurneys mostly for the living, and this is how they come these days. Useful for you, I think."
She checked Hendrickson's pulse, but she didn't at once take the red neckerchief off his face. Gilberto made coffee, strong and black, and poured it for himself and Jane, without sugar. Carmela had left a homemade ricotta pie to cool on a wire rack. Jane ate a large slice as a belated breakfast, while Gilberto adjourned to another room to speak with his wife by phone. By the time Jane finished eating, Hendrickson was muttering to himself. She washed her plate and fork, put them away, refreshed her mug of coffee, and took the scarf off his face. When he opened his pale green eyes, he was still floating on currents of chloroform, unaware that he was strapped down, in no condition to puzzle out her identity, not even fully aware of his own. He smiled dreamily up at her as she stood beside him. In a lotus-eater voice of indolent contentment, he said,
"Hey, sexy."
"Hey," she said.
"I got a use for that pretty mouth."
"I bet you do, big guy."
"Bring it on down here."
She licked her lips suggestively. He said,
"Uncle Ira is not Uncle Ira."
"Who is he then?" Hendrickson smiled patronizingly.
"No, that's not what you're supposed to say."
"What am I supposed to say, big guy?"
"You just say, all right."
"All right," she said.
"Blow me, gorgeous."
She puckered up and blew in his face.
"Funny,"
he said, and laughed softly and drifted off into the shallows of unconsciousness. Half a minute later, when he opened his eyes again, they were clearer, but he still smiled at her and recognized no danger.
"I know you from somewhere."
"Want me to refresh your memory?"
"I'm all ears."
"You people killed my husband, threatened to rape and kill my little boy, and have been trying to kill me for months." Slowly, his smile faded. 24. While Sanjay and Tanuja ate a late breakfast together at the kitchen table, their conversation ranged over a wide spectrum of subjects, as usual, including the novelette that Tanuja was in the middle of writing. Coming in from researching the rain the previous evening, she had slipped and fallen, and now she chewed her food judiciously on the left side of her mouth to give the split lip a chance to heal. Sanjay asked how she felt. She said she felt fine, that at least she hadn't broken a tooth. She asked what had happened to his right ear, which was when he realized that something must be wrong with it. As if the injury hadn't existed until she spoke of it, he felt a soreness, the heat of inflamed tissue. He touched the helix of his ear, the outer rim, and under the skin, loose fragments of broken cartilage ground together like shards of glass. He winced when his touch induced a throbbing in the flesh, and for a moment, it seemed not to be his own hand torturing the ear, but the hand of some man seated near him, though no one else was present except he and Tanuja. In his mind's eye, he saw an unfamiliar kitchen,
dark but for the quivering light from three sinuous tongues of candle flame. In that strange place, Tanuja stood in a doorway, looking back at him with something like sorrow, as she was led away. Led away. Leashed and collared like a dog. The image assaulted Sanjay vividly, and yet flickered out, as if it had been an illusion of shadow and candlelight. A still, small voice said that it meant nothing. Nothing at all. When he tried to summon that other kitchen to mind again, he couldn't. He must have said something, or his face contorted in a grotesque expression, because with concern his sister asked what was wrong. He assured her nothing was wrong. Nothing at all. Just that the injury to his ear puzzled him, as if he'd been sleepwalking, fell, and injured himself without waking. This led to a discussion of somnambulism, which Tanuja had once used as a plot device. By the time they moved on to another subject, the source of his injured ear no longer mattered to either of them, because it meant nothing. Nothing at all. After breakfast, Tanuja retreated to her office to work on the novelette, and Sanjay returned to his computer. A leisurely meal with his sister, accompanied by a spirited conversation, always inspired him when he returned to writing. But not today. Something had been different about their colloquy this time. He had not felt fully engaged, and she seemed distracted too. It was almost as if there was something that she needed to tell him, but she could not bring herself to speak of it, though each had always been frank with the other, each a sympathetic sounding board. Troubled, he called to the screen the stream of consciousness pages he'd written earlier and began to read them. The text was so feverish, non-linear, and bizarre that he couldn't imagine a magazine that would be interested in it, and there was no market for a book-length manuscript of this nature. Although he strove to make of his work a kind of art, he wrote to entertain, and he did not write what would not sell. Yet he had done just that this morning, not merely as an exercise, but with passion. And now, as he read the pages, this story of a man who failed to save a child, and by his failure in some way brought an end to all innocence and freedom, seemed to be some kind of allegory, a symbolical narrative in which nothing was what it appeared to be, written in a deep code, which even he, the writer, could not translate. Spiritualists believed in something called automatic writing, when a medium opened the door of his mind to any spirit that wished to communicate by way of him. What then flowed from pen to paper or keyboard to screen was the work not of the medium, but of an unknown entity speaking through the veil between the worlds of the living and the dead. But Sanjay wasn't a spiritualist and didn't believe in automatic writing. He could not account for these pages with that explanation. The more he read, the more he was affected by what he read, and the more urgently he felt impelled to continue writing this testament, until he came to a moment in the narrative that he did not recall writing, that affected him more powerfully than either the words or the action could explain. The two lead characters, man and child, were born to parents who had emigrated from India. As the child lay dying, he said to the man who had so utterly failed him, "Peripona," which meant, "I touch your feet," which was something that you said and did to someone you venerated, for someone who had earned the greatest respect, for someone before whom you felt such profound love that you humbled yourself completely. Sanjay's eyes were hot with tears. The screen before him blurred. For a while, he wept quietly, prodigiously, struggling to understand what this incomplete story, this flood of words, might mean. It seemed there would be no end either to his tears or to his desperate desire for enlightenment. But eventually the well of tears was drained,
and his burning eyes were as dry as they were sore. His need to understand what he had written faded. It had meant nothing. Nothing at all. He sat, staring at the screen, at the lines of words that had a short time ago seemed to be crazed poetry, crammed full of mysterious meaning expressed in elaborate patterns of symbols. Now, they were just words, a witless gush of language, perhaps resulting from a low-grade fever related to an infection, perhaps suggesting a transient ischemic attack, one of those mini-strokes caused by a temporary interruption of blood supply to a part of the brain, rare in someone his age, but not utterly without precedent. Nothing. The words meant nothing. Nothing at all. Sanjay deleted what he'd written. He opened another document, the manuscript he had been working on for 3 months. To settle himself into the mood of the novel and the voice of its narrator, he read the most recently composed chapter. Soon, he had recaptured the feel of it. He wrote a new sentence. Another. Eventually, he had a paragraph that worked well, and he was doing what he most enjoyed, the work he felt born to do. If there had been a ragged strangeness about the morning, his memory trimmed it into the neatness of ordinary experience. The next paragraph began with an elegant metaphor that surprised and pleased him, and already he was in the flow. His smartphone rang. He took the call. A man said, "Uncle Ira is not Uncle Ira." "Yes, all right," said Sanjay. "I will tell you what must happen this evening, and you will receive these instructions with equanimity. You will be neither afraid nor despairing. You will listen without emotion and will not ever question the rightness of what must occur. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
"When I end this call, you'll have no conscious awareness that it ever took place. You will return to whatever you were doing when I phoned, but you will act according to the instructions that you've been given. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
The man spoke for several minutes. He concluded with the words, "Auf Wiedersehen, Sanjay."
"Goodbye," he replied.
The next paragraph began with a metaphor that surprised and pleased him, and already he was in the flow, himself again, and back in form, in a dance with his favorite partner, the English language. 25. The black hair is the only element of disguise, and her blue eyes are as striking as Booth Hendrickson has heard them described by others who have been in her company and survived. A solemn-looking block of a man, the chauffeur himself, sans cap and sunglasses, in his unfortunate off-the-rack black suit, sits in a dinette chair. His hair is black, as are his eyes, and the coffee in his mug is so dark that it might have been water dredged from the River Styx. Clearly, he is meant to be intimidating, the crudest kind of muscle, a high school dropout with an IQ barely high enough to allow him to drive a car and pull a trigger. Booth Hendrickson can't be intimidated by such a man, who would no doubt define faux pas as the father of my enemy. He has used dozens like this thug, and, when necessary, has gotten rid of them to avoid any link between himself and what he's ordered them to do. Intelligence and wit will always triumph over brute strength. Intelligence, wit, and powerful connections, the last of which Booth has in abundance. Again, he looks up into the eyes of Jane Hawke and meets her sky-blue stare, and this time does not look away. "I phoned in your location, Simon's house. Maybe you skipped minutes before the hammer came down, but they're tracking you 1,000 different ways and closing fast."
1,000, huh? Surely that's hyperbole. He smiles.
"I like to hear pretty girls use big words. Which improve your vocabulary in 30 days course did you take? Did it include the term les majestés? If not, you would be well advised to look it up. A high crime committed against a sovereign state. Treason, she says. But it isn't applicable. You techno-Arcadians aren't a sovereign state. You're seditionists, totalitarians drunk on the promise of absolute power. You're the treasonist. That she knows they call themselves techno-Arcadians disturbs him. But he's not surprised that she has clawed this fact out of one of the people she's kidnapped and interrogated. With the slightest theatrical touch, she takes an iPhone from a jacket pocket and places it on the table as if it's a Fabergé egg. Evidently, she wants him to ask about it, but he will not. They are in a contest of wills, and he knows how to play these games. He says, "Who's accused of treason and executed for it depends on who controls the press and courts. You don't. Anyway, treason in pursuit of a perfect society is heroic." Her puzzlement is exaggerated, a mocking expression. A perfect society with people enslaved by brain implants? He smiles and rolls his head back and forth on the gurney. Not enslaved. They're given peace, released from worry, given direction they cannot otherwise find in their lives. As she unzips a leather tote bag that is standing on the table, Booth glances at the iPhone, wondering what she wants him to ask about it, so that he might ask something entirely different, if he mentions it at all. The phone becomes a secondary consideration when, from the tote, she extracts a large pair of scissors and smiles as she works the gleaming blades. She says, "Given direction, huh? Are there a lot of people who can't figure out how to live their lives? They're adrift? Lost?" "Don't play devil's advocate with me, Jane. You know as well as I do, millions waste their lives with drugs, booze. They can't find their way. They're indolent and ignorant and unhappy. By adjusting them, we give them a chance to be happy." "Really? Is that what you're doing, Boo? Giving them a chance to be happy? Gee, I don't know. It still looks like slavery to me." He pretends disinterest in the scissoring blades. He sighs. "Candidates for adjustment aren't chosen by race, religion, gender, or sexual orientation. No particular group is targeted. It can't be slavery if the purpose of every adjustment is to increase the amount of contentment and happiness in the world." "So you're quite the humanitarian, Boo. Maybe even a Nobel Peace Prize in your future." Booth intensely dislikes being called Boo. That is a nickname with which he'd been mocked in his youth. She may have discovered this or intuited it. She thinks that by needling him, ridiculing him, she can unnerve him, just as she will try to unnerve him with the scissors and perhaps other sharp instruments. But he endured so much mockery as a child that he is inured to it. And as for being cut or tortured, she will discover that he has more courage than she supposes and the endurance of stone. Besides, he knows she prides herself on operating as much as possible within traditional moral boundaries and will not stoop to physical torture. "Not every adjusted person is on your Hamlet list," she says. "But those who are, exactly how are they made happier by killing themselves?"
"I don't select them. The computer does."
"The computer model?"
"That's right. It selected your husband because he was likely to have a wrong-headed political career after leaving the Marines."
"Who designed the computer model?"
"Some exceedingly smart people, like Bertold Chenick and David James Michael." "Smarter than you and me, Janie," he assures her, though he is an intellectual equal to those men, and certainly her superior.
She says, "Chenick, Michael, both dead. How smart could they have been?" He does not deign to answer that snarky non sequitur. He realizes they have taken off his suit coat. It lies jumbled on a counter where it has been tossed as if it's a rag.
They should have had enough decency to ensconce a Dior suit coat in a closet on a hanger. The wide strap across his thighs will surely leave severe wrinkles diagonal to the pleats in his pant legs. Using the scissors to point at the iPhone on the table, Jane Hawk says, "Are you wondering about the phone?"
"What's to wonder about? It's just a phone, Janie."
"It's the one you took from the woman you carjacked." Booth shrugs in his restraints, but a sudden excitement stirs in him, which he must conceal. "You used that phone to contact your people and call them down on me," she says. "Now I have the number you inputted."
"Which is worth nothing to you."
"Really? Nothing?" "Think about it, Boo." He's thinking about it all right. When he called J-Spotter, the team automatically stored the number of that phone. Now that he has gone missing, they can use the number to quickly obtain the unique locator signal the phone produces. It is essentially a GPS transponder that will allow them to track her to this place sooner than later. She looks at the chauffeur and works the scissors, and he smiles at her as if he knows what's coming. She moves closer to the gurney, clicking the scissors, trying to get Booth to ask what she's going to do with them, but of course he does not ask. When she pulls on a thick lock of his hair and cuts off a 3 or 4 inch length, Booth is surprised and displeased.
"What the hell?"
"To remember you by," she says, but then drops the hair on the floor. "Though I'm afraid I've spoiled your perfect... what do you call it?"
"What do I call what?"
"Your do. Your stylish hairdo. What do you call it?"
"Don't be ridiculous."
"Do you call it a haircut?"
"I don't call it anything."
"No, you wouldn't call it a haircut. Too common. You probably call it a coiffure. A man of your stature goes to a coiffeuse to be coiffed." A small laugh escapes the black-suited thug, whether genuine or part of a practiced routine is hard to tell. "How much do you pay when you go to the coiffeuse, Boo?"
"Mockery doesn't work with me," he assures her.
"Do you pay $100? Booth does not reply. "I've insulted him," she says to the thug at the table. "Must be 200 at least, maybe 3. Booth realizes he is staring at the iPhone on the table. He looks away from it, lest she see his interest. She turns to him again. "How much do you pay the coiffeuse to cut your hair?" She wishes to define him as a shallow elitist, and he refuses to be that person, for he is not that person, not of that class, not of her class, either, not of any class. Above all concepts of class, caste, and echelon. He says nothing. In an instant, she goes from ice to fire, her face contorted by rage and flushed with hatred. With a sudden fury, she snarls, "What do you pay for a haircut, asshole?" As she speaks, her right hand arcs high and then down, driving the scissors into the 2-inch-thick vinyl-covered mattress, so close to his face that he startles in spite of himself. Vinyl and dense foam padding split as flesh might, and the points of the blades wrap against the steel substrate as if against bone. She wants him to believe that the death of her husband and the peril in which her child lives and these long months on the run have driven her to the edge of sanity, that she might snap, butchering him before she quite realizes what she's done. But he knows her too well to be conned by this performance. He has reviewed in detail the cases she solved while an agent of the FBI, a record of brilliant deduction, wise strategies, and smart techniques. For months, she has eluded capture, even though the combined resources of federal, state, and local law enforcement have been committed to the search for her. Her sanity is a stone that can't be cracked. Nevertheless, as the scissors flash past his face and gouge the mattress, he glances at the iPhone, attempting by an act of sheer willpower to summon the SWAT teams that surely must be en route. She leans toward him, her rage gone as abruptly as it came, her unblemished face serene and exquisitely erotic in its serenity. Her lips are 8 or 10 inches from his when she presses the closed blades of the scissors against the lower lid of his left eye. The steel is cold and the point pricking. In almost a whisper, she says, "Do you know why I put the phone on the table, Boo? Hmm? To give you hope. So that when you hoped, I could take your hope away from you. Like you've taken hope from so many people. I hammered a screwdriver blade into the charging port of that phone, Boo. Split the battery. No juice. No locator signal. No one's tracking it. No one's coming to save you." Her eyes are at least 3 shades of blue, alternating in the striations of the irises, those thin circular layers of muscle like the folds of Japanese fans. The kitchen fluorescence treating each grade of pigment differently, so that her stare seems radiant not by reflection, but because of some internal light. Her pupils are black holes, their gravity alarming. She still speaks softly, but now as tenderly as a lover. "Tell me, Booth, what else must I take away from you in order to make you talk? Your eyes? So you can see no evil? What a terrible, terrible loss, considering the delight you take in seeing the evil you do." She moved the scissors to his lips. "Your lying tongue? Then you'd have to answer all my questions in writing while swallowing so much blood." She takes the scissors away from his lips, but doesn't press them to another part of him. Instead, she startles him by reaching back with her left hand and caressing his crotch, fondling his package through his suit pants. "Do you go to Aspasia, Booth?" The elegant and highly secret houses of pleasure, reserved for the wealthiest supporters of the Techno-Arcadian mission, are called Aspasia, named after the mistress of Pericles, the famous statesman and mayor of Athens, circa 400 BC, Booth is disquieted to learn that she knows about Aspasia, as closely guarded a secret as any the Arcadians keep. "There are 4 of them," she whispers. "Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, Washington. Have you tried them all, Booth? I've spent a little time touring the Aspasia in Los Angeles. The revelation that she has been in one of these highly secure palaces of Eros alarms him, and he tells himself that she is lying. The twin colonnades of magnificent phoenix palms that flank the long driveway, she says, the courtyard with its swimming pool as big as a lake, tens of millions of dollars of art and antiques, so much marble and granite and gilding. It's all so classy that dirty little perpetual adolescents can go there and feel like big, important men. She is not lying. She has been to Aspasia. The truth of her mood is not in the softness with which she speaks and the tenderness with which she teases him through his pants. The truth is in her stare, her eyes now radiant with fury. What she saw at Aspasia has not merely outraged her. She clearly found it an abomination, for she is filled now with loathing, and the light in her eyes is the light of abhorrence. One of the girls in Aspasia is a gorgeous Eurasian, maybe 18, 19. Her name is Lu Ling. Well, you know. That's her whore name, given to her. She doesn't remember her real name or what she once was, doesn't remember her family, nothing of her past. She doesn't even possess the concept of a past or a future. All that and more has been scrubbed from her mind. She lives only in the moment, Boo, smiling and attentive, without any inhibitions. You might call her a blithe spirit, if there was any spirit left in her. She lives only to submit to those who use her, to satisfy their every desire. Cool, huh? Just thinking about it should fill out the pouch in your briefs, Boo. He dares not speak. He believes now that he has misjudged her capacity for cruelty. Her soft voice fades to a breathless whisper. Do you have extreme desires, Booth? Do you like rough sex? Rougher than rough. Do you like to hear them cry? Bravado and ostentatious assertion of his superiority have in the past always gotten Booth through tight passages. His mind races now as he considers what to say and do. Her face, 6 inches from his, her hand still moving sensuously over the crotch of his pants, her warm breath on his face. Mama's boy is terrified of me, isn't he? If he wasn't, there'd be at least some stiffening of his little man, but there's none at all. Terror is a good thing if it makes you face the truth. Agree to tell me everything I want to know about the Arcadians, because if you don't, not even your mind is dark enough to imagine what I'll do to you. If he rats out the Arcadians, they will surely torture and kill him as a turncoat. His fellow conspirators are infinitely more bloody-minded than this bitch, who is still more of a straight arrow than not. In the past few months, she's given him lots of headaches, some of them as fierce as migraines. Maybe she's capable of greater cruelty than he thought, but she will not, unlike certain of his associates, cut out his tongue or cut off his balls. She terrifies him, yes, but bravado and reliance on his superiority are, now as always, his best hope. Fear has flooded his mouth with saliva, and he puts it to good use, spitting copiously in her face from a distance of 6 inches. He expects her contained fury to erupt, expects to be slapped and clawed, but her face is still serene, and she doesn't touch him. She remains bent over him for a moment, and then slowly rises to her full height. She stands in silence, staring down at him without expression. Perhaps a minute passes, during which she does not wipe her face. Pearls of spittle glimmer on her cheeks, her chin, and a slimy, silvery string depends from the tip of her perfect nose. She turns away from him and goes to the sink, but she doesn't pull a paper towel from the holder and blot herself or turn on the water. She stares out the window. Her reaction is so unexpected that Booth's dread grows with the continued silence. He is reluctant to look away from her, but then he rolls his head to the right on the gurney and regards the thug in the black suit, who stares back with eyes as black as those holes in desert sand from which tarantulas burst forth. Jane Hawk turns from the sink and says to her companion, "I'm going to use the bathroom. Quiet him for me while I'm gone." "Chloroform?" he asks. "No. Gag him. Tape him." She doesn't look at Booth again, but walks out of the kitchen, his spittle still wet upon her face. Her words replay in Booth's memory. "Not even your mind is dark enough to imagine what I'll do to you." 26. In her office, Tanuja Shukla sat at the computer, moving her lonely character, Subhadra, through a night of wind and rain, on a journey ominous and mysterious, but ultimately magical. The sentences failed to form with the usual felicity, but there was satisfaction in the struggle. Her smartphone ringtone was a few bars of "What a Wonderful World." She smiled and let the music repeat, as she usually did, while she sang, "I see skies of blue and clouds of white." Then she answered it. A vaguely familiar man's voice said, "Uncle Ira is not Uncle Ira." "Yes, all right," Tanuja said. She listened to what must happen that evening, and she said she understood, that she would act according to instructions. After he was finished, the caller said, "Auf Wiedersehen, sweet lips." "Goodbye," she said, and put aside her phone and returned to the novelette in progress. After a moment, she sang, "I see trees of green and red roses too," as she reached for the phone. But the music did not repeat. No call was incoming. Either the caller had let it ring once before hanging up, or Tanuja had imagined the ringtone. She stared at the phone in puzzlement for a moment. Then she shrugged and returned to her story about Subhadra in the storm. Now and then, she absent-mindedly touched the wounded corner of her mouth, but the bleeding had stopped hours ago, and her fingers always came away dry.
27. In the half-bath, at the sink, Jane washed her face with soap and water and rinsed it and dried with a guest towel. She leaned against the vanity, staring into the mirror, into her eyes, which lately seemed alien to her, and she wondered if she could really do what she intended to do. Even as a young girl, she had never spent a lot of time gazing into mirrors. She could see too much of her mother in her face, so that her reflection was a reminder of grievous loss. Not least of all, the image in the looking glass reminded her of the confusion and self-doubt and fear and cowardice that had paralyzed her when, as a 9-year-old child, she hadn't been able to accuse her father of murdering her mother, though she'd had good reason to believe. No, she had known that he'd killed her and staged it as a suicide. We grow, we change, we labor to maturity, to what little wisdom we might ever acquire, but always in the mirror is who we were as well as who we are, a harking back and, yet again, a quiet reckoning. The problem this time was not cowardice. No courage was needed to do to Booth Hendrickson what she intended. Instead, ruthlessness was required. She needed a hardened heart. If not hardened to all the world, at least to those who lacked the ability to see their own humanity in others, who preyed on others, who recognized no right to life except their own, for whom power was no less essential than air and water. The world had always been a crawl with their squamous kind in nuisance numbers, but these days they flourished as never before. After centuries of compounding technological advances had put into their hands more power than kings of old had dreamed, power that should be entrusted only to benign gods. She could not interrogate Hendrickson using the techniques she had found successful with other subjects. His arrogance was both a suit of armor and a fortress. The deepest roots of his psychology, like those of his brother, were snarled in a Gordian knot, first tied in his earliest childhood and elaborated on since then. The man now in his 40s might appear to be a mighty oak, but he was rotten at the core, all his limbs and branches deformed. And leafless, if it could be said that leaves were a sign of health. He was a maze of deception, a primal forest of deceit, and she could trust the answers he gave her only at considerable peril. With such a man, she had no choice but to be extraordinarily cruel. Of course, uncountable psychopaths resorted to that same rationalization. She closed her eyes and tried to call to mind her son as she had last seen him, in the ranch-fenced exercise yard adjacent to the stable at Gavin and Jessica Washington's place, where he was hidden away and safe, dappled by sunlight and oak-leaf shadows, standing on a low stool, grooming the mane of the Exmoor pony named Hannah that Gavin and Jessie had recently bought for him, his hair dark and tousled like his father's, and stirring in the light breeze, his eyes the blue of hers, although clear with an innocence that she had lost long ago. In the past, at the end of each of her infrequent visits, he had walked with her to her car and watched as she had driven away. But he could no longer bear parting in that manner. On this most recent occasion, soon after Jane's arrival, he'd made it known, through Jessica, that when the time came for his mother to leave,
she should just pretend that she was going out to sit on the porch or into the next room to read, something like that, without saying the word goodbye. And so she had stood for a while, watching him groom Hannah, talking about how quickly he was becoming a confident rider under Gavin's tutelage, about how smart Hannah was and about how much the pony enjoyed the company of the German shepherds, Duke and Queenie. As always, a moment came when the deep heart sorrow of